Accession number 27208, Reel 2.
For the week, Reel 2. So after you'd soloed the aircraft, what was the next stage? What did you have other things to learn? I mean, I think you mentioned night flying being one of them.
Indeed, yes. Oh, yes, you have a lot of things to learn. And consolidate what you've already learned. It's really concerned with proper and safe ability to fly the aircraft successfully. And night flying is certainly one of them. And there's a great concentration on instrument flying. And for instrument flying practice, you have a hood, like a hood over a car, really, and it's called flying under the hood, and the instructor will select this hood, and I seem to remember he doesn't select it, the instructor takes the aircraft off, and you're under the hood all the way, as far as I remember, so you can't see anything, and it's really not very pleasant, because you can't see, you don't know what's going on, except by your instruments. And then the instructor will give you a request to do certain exercises under the hood. Turn towards the E030, rate one turn to the right onto 030, go, and off you go, and try that, maintaining height precisely as you do that. And just a matter of being able to fly the aircraft in conditions in which you've got no horizon and nothing to guide you except the instruments in front of you in a cockpit. And of course these instruments in those days are fairly basic. You know, the airspeed indicator, the artificial horizon, which of course is a gyro which shows you a bar across the centre of the instrument, which represents the horizon, will maintain its position because of the gyro. You fly on that. You've got a turn and bank indicator, which you will have to keep either central if you're not doing any turning, or if you are doing turning, you will be asked to do it at an appropriate rate. And as I remember, rate one turn is the ability to turn 360 degrees in 1 minute, I think. And you turn the aircraft, you maneuver the controls to set the wings to a turn, which you will see on the instruments in front of you, a rate one turn, and maintaining height at the same time, you will keep the instrument on the rate one turn, probably for 108 degrees or something like that, whatever the instructor says you should do. It's really quite tricky at first, especially in the Tiger Moth. It's not an easy airplane to fly accurately. And then you do the spinning and the aerobatics and so on, and just consolidate your ability to properly fly the aircraft until you're considered competent to go on something else.
How easy initially is it to trust those instruments when you are flying in an aircraft?
Well, you've got to forget the seat of your pants. You've got to forget your bum and the feeling that you get that the aircraft's doing something other than what the instruments are showing you. And that can be quite difficult to do. You've got to concentrate your mind on that and forget everything but those instruments, especially if the weather's a bit rough, the air's a bit rough and bumpy. No, it's not easy. Not easy.
You also mentioned that you practiced kind of forced landings as well. Was there a lot of emphasis on that?
Well, you were considered to be... The government didn't like you to break airplanes, and there were pilots, even in those days, were moderately expensive to train. And so if you did have an engine failure on a single-engine airplane, it meant a forced landing. And the engines, reciprocating engines of those days, were not as reliable as they are now. The jets are. And it was important to be able to understand the rate of descent that the aircraft would assume in the event of an engine failure, and having that knowledge and the knowledge of the area around you to be able to position yourself in hopefully in a position where you could get down on some poor old farmer's field, hopefully without any cows on it. So it was important.
Were there any things to look for on the ground, obviously, if you were going to make a forced landing that were important to notice in your choice of field?
Well, there were lots of things. Power cables, for instance, are not generally regarded as being useful. It was just using common sense, but what to do. And, of course, you had to do it and find out where the wind was, look at the way the wind was blowing and the trees about and things, and position yourself into wind.
Obviously, after you'd soloed, did you do any low flying at all?
Yes, we did low flying, yep. Yep.
How was
both
that?
Authorised and unauthorised, of course. Yes. No, you had to do that. They still do it. If you go up in the Highlands, Scotland, you hear them doing it all the time. It's good. Yeah. But you didn't go desperately low. You weren't supposed to go desperately low, not right down onto the ground. But sort of something like a couple hundred feet.
Is the relationship between yourself, obviously, and the ground when you're doing low flying completely different from when you've been doing most of your practice at a higher altitude?
It's much more exciting, of course, and it is different. Yes, you have to. Well, you've got the contours of the ground to consider as well as the aircraft's proper manoeuvrability.
Again, are there any things that you should be aware of when doing low flying?
Well, you're not supposed to do. As far as I remember, again, common sense would suggest that you don't do it over populated areas and over fields with cattle and that sort of thing, and of course power cables and so on, just using it. But we used to have low flying areas, I seem to remember, where you were, these are the areas you did to do the official bit of the low flying.
Did you any cross countries at that stage?
Indeed, yes, we did that.
What would that entail?
Well, you'd be given the map and you'd have to draw out on the map a track giving you to the points which you were supposed to, you'd been asked to identify, and fly to that, and then fly to somewhere else and fly back again for about maybe 3/4 of an hour or something like that. Oh yeah, it was important to do that. A copy of Bradshaw was always useful too, because you could read the names of the railway stations in the early part of the war. I think they painted them out after a bit.
So what happened when you'd finished your initial flying training or your elementary flying training? What was the next stage?
Off to Canada what was it called? That was EFTS. Right. SFTS, that's right. SFTS and Harvard's, Kingston, Ontario.
How did you get to Canada?
Queen Elizabeth.
What was that like to travel on board?
Very, very interesting indeed. Very interesting. First thing I remember, we embarked at Greenock, and we went on a tender and were ferried out to the vessel, which is enormous, of course, 85,000 tons. And we went down to the mess deck where we'd been allocated to. And there in the mess deck there was a long table and long chair seats, each side of it, typical mess deck. But the great thing was this table and all the tables in this quite large area had two stainless steel containers, and one of them contained hundreds of hard-boiled eggs and the other contained loaves of white bread. And we had seen nothing but dried egg and brown bread for some time, so that was a great, great benefit. The food was very good. But there were, well, I was in a cabin for two, and there were 16 of us in that cabin. Berths four deep from the floor up, four of them, 16 of us.
Did you have any duties on board?
We had sort of invented duties to keep us busy, but things like guarding the guarding the dining room door. I seem to remember doing that in the middle of the night. But the meals, I think there were only something like 4 hours in the night when meals weren't being served because there were so many people. Can't remember how many, 1,000, 6,000 maybe. Yeah.
And where did you land?
I think it was Halifax, if I remember. Yeah.
And what were your initial impressions of Canada at that time?
Because bloody cold. It was the winter time. Yeah. But we're there again. We were put into a transit camp, and the food was good. We were quite well looked after for about a couple of weeks, I think. And then we went on a train across Canada to Kingston, as I said. And then we flew Harvards in the winter time.
What was the difference, obviously, between the elementary flying that you'd done and the advanced? Obviously, the Harvard being a monoplane, but were there major differences in what you were learning?
Oh, indeed. You were, by that time, assumed to know how to keep the aircraft in one piece, both in takeoff and landing and flying it, even in bad weather. And so they were able to give you more advanced things, and particularly military things like dive bombing. I forgot, I think couple of different types of bombing we used to do. Did we do firing? I don't think we did. Can't remember whether we did air firing at that point, but we certainly did bombing. It's good fun.
What did that entail? What do you have to know? You know, what's the procedures for doing a dive bombing? Any things to remember?
Well, it was winter time. The lakes were frozen, and Lake Ontario had a target on it, and you had to go to that target with your dummy bomb and attack it and drop it as near as possible to the target. I'm not sure we did much actual dive bombing, because the Harvard isn't a dive bombing aeroplane. But we did dip down and drop this thing from a fairly low height and hope that it would arrive in the right place. It was all great sport, really. And they paid us for doing it too, but not much.
What was the Harvard like as an aircraft?
It's a very good airplane. It's a very good training airplane, certainly. But I remember when I looked at it at first, and I climbed up in the wing and opened the cockpit door, looked in, and I counted 103 instruments and controls. 103. I thought, I'll never remember all these. But happily, familiarity is a wonderful thing, and you get used to it, and you don't have to deal with them all at once, anyway.
What was different, obviously, between British aircraft and American aircraft at the time? Was there any major differences in the kind of aircraft design that they would have?
Well, they were a different class of aircraft, so I would think they. It's hard to say. The instrumentation's the same. They're just the Harvard's a more powerful and more sophisticated aeroplane in every way than the Tiger Moth. But I don't think any difference between being an American aircraft or a British aircraft at that stage would have been significant.
It has obviously a retractable undercarriage.
Yes.
Did that cause any problems with people who'd worked, obviously coming from the Tiger Moth, with a fixed undercarriage at all?
I don't actually remember any wheels up landings. I think the controllers were pretty good at looking out of the window and firing off a red very light if somebody came in having forgotten the wheels. No, I don't remember any serious trouble about that. But we had problems. Well, the problem was that it was an airport, a civilian airport, Kingston, but it was covered in snow, very deep snow. So instead of having runways, they rolled the whole surface of the aircraft, of the airport, was rolled flat by tractors with corrugated heavy rollers behind them. So it was a packed snow surface, which is a jolly good surface to use, but of course it wasn't easy to determine the height you were when you're on the final part of the landing approach.
How would you determine height? Because you mentioned on the Tiger Moth that you had some blades of grass for landing.
Well, you just sort of hoped, I suppose. I'll get used to it, sort of. But it's not so easy as it had been on grass, that's true. I think that may have been one reason why the tractors made corrugations on the surface of the snow so that it would be easier to identify the surface that way. Hang on a minute. Yes, sir.
So was there anything about the Harvard that you remember, other than what we've discussed?
Oh, well, there are two things that I can remember. One is that the very high tip speed of the propeller meant that it was at high revs. The tips revolved at above the speed of sound, so it was very noisy. And the other thing was it had rather a vicious spin. It wasn't an easy airplane to get out of the spin. But it came out. You had to allow plenty of height to be able to do it.
So it was just a matter of height rather than anything else?
Yes, I think so.
At that point, obviously, when you completed your training there, was that the point that you were commissioned as a pilot?
Yes. Yeah, the end of that.
How did that feel?
Yeah, it was very good. Yeah, because it was quite tough, actually. It took a long time. I can't remember exactly how long. It was over a year, I'm sure, the training process altogether.
Was there a failure rate amongst the training pilots?
There was quite a high failure rate and quite a high death rate as well. I was always very upset that the fact that safety wasn't regarded quite so importantly, I think, as pressing on. And pilots and aircraft weren't so expensive then as they are now. And quite a few people died in training.
Was there any particular causes of those fatal accidents?
I don't seem to remember so, no, I don't think so. I don't remember what the causes might have been. I remember there were quite a few. I've got a photograph somewhere of the course with those who didn't make it and those who were killed. I've got halos around the ones who were killed and bowler hats and on the ones who didn't make it. But there are quite a few. I would say perhaps, I don't know, a fifth of the course, perhaps. I didn't make it for one reason or another.
With those who failed the course, was it generally some aspect that they couldn't get the hang of, having come that far through the elementary training, that sort of thing?
Oh, I don't know, really. It's quite strict. You had to pass. It was quite tough, too. You had to do the right things. Some people just weren't up to it.
And what happens, obviously, when they fail the course? Would they remove very quickly?
Yes, they just disappeared, never heard of them again. But they weren't actually bumped off, I don't think.
Would they return to other naval duties?
Oh, indeed, they'd go back to other naval duties.
So, as you finished the course, where did you go to from there, then?
Yeovilton.
And what was that to do at Yeovilton? Was that?
That was, as far as I remember, that was sea fires, I think, and hurricanes.
So was it a conversion course onto fighters at that point?
Yes.
What did that entail, obviously, converting? Because although you've been flying the monoplane with the Harvard, I imagine both the Hurricanes and Sea Fires are much more powerful aircraft.
Yes, much, much more powerful, much less forgiving, and, of course, no dual control. So you just had to be told what to do, and jolly well go and do it.
How competent at that stage, obviously having done all your training, did you feel to take control of such a powerful aircraft?
not very confident. No, they were quite terrifying at first, because they were very powerful, and you've only got to hear one, the Merlin's roar. Mm-hmm.
Was there any stage, obviously, at your training where they determined that you would be converting onto fighters, say, as opposed to torpedo bombers or some other?
Yes, well, they decided that in Kingston, I think. Yeah. I don't know, actually. Anyway, I went to Yubut and flew Seafires and Hurricanes. Yeah.
Can you tell me something about, obviously, the Seafire, what it was like and its characteristics?
Well, it was a very nice aeroplane to fly. You didn't so much climb into it as wrap it round you. The cockpit was small, but somehow when you closed the cockpit door, it was close to you and you felt almost part of it. It was a well-designed cockpit and a well-designed aeroplane. It was a beautiful aeroplane to fly, there's no doubt of that. It's lovely. It had one or two disadvantages. It didn't have fuel injection. It had a carburetor, which meant that if you flew upside down for any period, the engine stopped. And I always thought that it was a disadvantage that it had a glycol and water-cooled engine, so that if something got into that engine, like a piece of shrapnel or a bullet, then the water would drain away and the engine would stop. Much keener on air-cooled engines, where that doesn't happen quite to the same extent. No, it doesn't happen at all. But it was a beautiful airplane to fly. No doubt about that. It's a great privilege to be able to do so.
What was visibility like? I'm thinking along the lines of taxiing or...
Oh, very poor. Taxiing was terrible. You had to move your nose left and right to be able to see in front of you. Your nose was just sitting up in front of you. And the only trouble was that you had the dual business of having to move the nose left and right to see in front of you, which meant you couldn't go very fast taxiing. And the boiling point of the water was such in the engine, without a strong airflow going over the air cooling system, that the engine could boil, and the glycol could boil, and that wasn't regarded as being a good thing to do, because it could ruin the engine. So taxiing was difficult. It wasn't designed for taxiing. It was designed to sit on a grass field and chaps go rushing over and leap into it and go straight off. But it was really a fault of the aircraft, that was.
I'd also heard that it wasn't very robust for naval operations, because one of the things being the undercarriage being quite, well, not very sturdy.
when I did my deck landing training, we started off with half a dozen aeroplanes. I think we finished up with one after a fortnight. Was it a fortnight or a week? Because either the undercarriage had buckled, or apart from the fact that one or two went into the barrier in the front, and that didn't do them any good. But one aircraft broke its back, I remember, with a heavy landing. It was not designed for naval operations at all.
Did you do your deck landing at Yeovilton?
Did dummy deck landings at Yeovilton, the proper deck landings on a ship called the Ravager and the Clyde.
When you did them at Yeovilton, the dummy ones, what did that entail? Did they have an area marked off specifically?
Yes, they marked off the runway with white lines signifying the round down, the back end of the aircraft carrier, and then the four wires across the deck, and they simulated that by painting white lines across. And they had a batsman, a proper, fully trained batsman, who brought you in, gave you the cut, and so on. And it was very, 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 training was good.
And I believe the Navy has a slightly different way of landing than the RAF as well. You do a three-point landing?
Yes, well, we had to land as slowly as possible. And we brought them in at 65 knots, I remember, which is very, very slow for a fighter monoplane. And then when they gave us the cut, of course, the aircraft had stalled onto the deck, three-point, which is the only way to do it, really. But it was not good for the aeroplane, and it wasn't a good aeroplane for deck landing operations.
What about the Hurricane? Was that different?
It was a bit more robust, but I didn't have experience of flying it onto the deck, so I don't know.
Was it different in many ways from the Seafarer at all? Because you mentioned the Seafarer wrapped itself around you. Was it a different feel in a Hurricane at all?
Slightly, yes. It was slightly bigger cockpit, I seem to remember. It also had an interesting thing in takeoff, because when people used to take off for the first time, never having, of course, been able to fly a dual in the machine on a Hurricane, you would see them leave the end of the runway, and then the aeroplane would do peculiar gyrations while it was trying to climb away and get its undercarriage up. And the reason for that was that you raised the wheels in the Hurricane by means of a lever on the bottom left-hand side of the cockpit. You had to lean down to get to that lever, and as a safety precaution, well, it was like a car's gear lever in a way, and the purpose of it was to both raise the flaps, raise and lower the flaps, and raise and lower the undercarriage. So it was a four position slotted gear area into which the gear lever went. And so you had to lean down, you had to determine where the one that you wanted, which operation you wanted to do. You had to move the lever to that position, and in the case of the undercarriage, there was a catch, and you had to feel for this catch, release it, and then raise the undercarriage. Now, all this time, you can't look out of the window, and you don't know where the thing is, and it's the first time you've done it, so people are going all over the place after their initial takeoff until they got used to this. Yeah. That was the Hurricane.
Have any incidents occurred while you were at Yorvalton that spring to mind?
Oh, not really, no. No.
At that stage, did you have any training in fighter tactics, though? Were there any specific kind of aerial combat that you would engage in?
You know, I can't remember much of what I did. I went to Yorvalton twice, in fact. The first time I went, I didn't get through, and they chucked me out after a few couple of weeks or so. I never knew quite why. Anyway, I didn't get through. And so it's a bit of a blur, first Yorvalton time. Yeah.